This is about the attention economy. It's about disinformation in public life. It's about data protection and the collapse of the international, the post-war order. Some people have criticized it because it's like three encyclicals in one, but I think in some ways he has his finger on the point that this technocratic paradigm is driving social change on a massive scale in all sorts of ways. And you really can't narrate that story without looking at lots of these impacts.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. I'm joined today by our editor, Mark Michael, and executive director, Matthew Olver, for coverage and commentary of three of our top news stories in the Anglican world. Story number one, Magnifica Humanitas. Well, this isn't really a story in the Anglican world. It's more like a story in the world. If you've not read, we encourage you to read or read and listen to coverage about Pope Leo's first and recent encyclical. It is a special, even unique papal letter in many ways that we'll touch on today. And its topic, artificial intelligence, as well as its tone, are urgent. The letter asks not just, what is the church's response, but what do human response and choice and responsibility look like here? Not just acting after the advances have occurred, but also thinking about reflecting how we want these advances to occur as a global human community, thinking and praying and reflecting and acting on the front end rather than just reacting as the technology develops. Really, really rich stuff. We released a series on our online blog, Covenant, responding to the encyclical, also packed with good stuff. Anglicans, like Catholics, are asking, how is our moment like the moments of, say, the 19th century intensifying turn of industrialization? How is our moment like that one decisive? What is similar about previous decisive technological advances and responses to them? And what is distinct about our moment? We'll also look into an ongoing story of jihadist persecution and interfaith resilience in the Diocese of Cabo Delgado, Mozambique, as well as take a glimpse into the character of the Anglican Church in Myanmar through their post-colonial witness to unity and the life of an Anglican seminary there. Finally, in our bonus segment today, I had the pleasure of sitting down with our freshly retired associate editor, Douglas LeBlanc, to ask him for some final reflections on his career, changes in the Episcopal Church, in journalism, and in himself over the decades. Just a little nudge for those of you who have been looking forward to our Radiant Pages Conference, September 24th to 26th, that you can get 10% off your tickets right now as a thank you for listening to the show. The website is livingchurch.org/events, and the code is TLCPOD10. You can also just head to the show notes where we've popped that info in. Radiant Pages is a gathering for clergy and laity on loving and reading the Bible afresh. And we put this conference together with a group of Episcopal priests, starting with the question, what do Episcopalians tend to ask about Scripture? What are the common struggles we have with Scripture? And so we'll go deep with our conversations and talks at the conference, but it will also be accessible with a pastoral teaching vibe and a relaxed and friendly atmosphere. Finally, we invite you, if you have something to ask about our conversation today, or something to add to it, something to disagree with, join in by writing to letters@livingchurch.org. That will send a letter to the editor. Or you can write to me, ambernoel@livingchurch.org. We would love to hear from you. Now, pull up your 1950s roller chair, put in that earpiece. We are headed to the news desk. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Mark, Matthew, thank you so much for joining me at the news desk.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
I used to have a coworker who was German, and she would always talk about the importance of being meek and humble. So thank you for coming on my Meek and Humble Living Church podcast. I appreciate that. So we're going to start off our news desk today talking about, well, how about that new pope? He already has put out an encyclical, and this one, Tackling AI. If you haven't read bits of the encyclical or listened to podcasts about it yet, you really should. I've included a link to the encyclical in the show notes. But I've also included links to some articles in Covenant, our online theological journal. I think we've published four, and these have to do with Anglican responses to the encyclical. Matthew, can you tell us a little bit about the encyclical Magnifica Humanitatis on safeguarding the human person in the time of artificial intelligence? And then also a little bit about that Anglican response to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the first encyclical that's been issued by our relatively new Pope, Pope Leo XIV, and Magnifica Humanitas, published on the 25th of last month.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry, Matthew. It's Magnifica Humanitas. Did I say it wrong? Or is it Humanitatis?
Tatis. It's in the genitive.
You're right. It is Magnifica. It is Magnifica Humanitas. I have been reading Humanitatis also. Okay, so note to the audience, it is Magnifica Humanitas. So if you see it written otherwise, it is wrong, even if it means well. Okay, so please tell us about Magnifica Humanitas and Anglican reception.
Well, fun Latin games. One of the things that's interesting, speaking of Latin, is that typically, papal encyclicals are issued in Latin, at least the authoritative edition, and this has not yet been issued in Latin. The Pope issued it, spoke about it in English, which is itself quite unique as our first Pope from the United States. So he personally presented the encyclical, which was itself another unusual piece. Usually that's been delegated to cardinals or others. And the presentation was attended by AI experts and other theologians, including the Anthropic co-founder, Chris Ola, which was quite interesting, who I don't think himself is a Christian. And speaking of the other people that were involved, one of the writers of one of the covenant pieces, Sam Tranter, was personally invited to be there for that. So lots of things about this, I think, are wonderful. The ecumenical orientation, I think, is explicit. The date of the publication was selected to fall on the 135th anniversary of the publication of Rerum Novarum, which was the landmark encyclical about industrialization written by Pope Leo XIII in 1891. And lots of people consider that the foundational text of modern Catholic social teaching. So he's situating this very, very consciously within a trajectory, really, of the 20th century papal teaching about what it looks like to live in the modern world and addressing specific concerns that, you know, all Christians are facing, not just Catholics. Really addressed to all people of goodwill, not even just Christians. And that, I think, is noteworthy. The encyclical itself is very long. It's basically like a short book. It's like 100 pages. It has an introduction and conclusion, and it's divided out into five chapters. The first one is a dynamic approach of the faithful to the gospel. The second one is on foundations and principles of social doctrine, so basically Catholic social teaching. Chapter three is on technology and dominance. And here, thinking about the nature of humanity, he says the grandeur of humanity in the light of the promises of AI. Chapter four is focused on what does it mean to care and be attentive to the needs of human beings in this time of transformation. The value of work was one of the main themes of Rerum Novarum back in the 19th century. And so he's thinking about what does AI also mean about human dignity as it relates to work, to jobs. And then the last chapter is the culture of power and the civilization of love. I might just call out a couple of things and then we can have a conversation. I mean, he has a couple interesting notes, I think, at the beginning. One of the things that marks this is that this is being constructed or built not by nation states, but by transnational entities, corporations, whose goal is profit And that fact should cause us to look at, make sure that we're also looking at this financially. I think when we had the previous podcast with Bishop Sumner and with Arlie, one of the things she wanted to highlight was, remember, these companies exist to make money. So the ways in which they are going to present themselves to you, you must always keep this financial piece in mind. So the fact that it responds to you like a person, you know, if you're on Claude or chat, that's not accidental. And that's not how actually scientists and researchers engage with AI. They actually engage with it in zeros and ones, like in a terminal, not in an intrapersonal simulation. So this prophet is key. He also introduces two biblical images that I think are interesting. So the one is Babel, and then the other is the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem in the book of Jeremiah.
Nehemiah.
So Babel results not in unity, but in dispersions, he says. In contrast, the walls, he says, I'm going to quote him here, the narrative shows how the city is reborn, not through the initiative of one man, but through the shared responsibility of all, men, women, priests, artisans, heads of households, and young people all play a part. It is an undertaking with God at the center, which rebuilds relationships before rebuilding with stones. That's like quite beautiful and also quite rich. And also setting out a biblical vision of what are the kinds of fundamental tasks that actually bring human beings together. He also sets out, I think, an interesting claim about technology in and of itself, and then situating AI as a particular kind of technology. He writes, in the abstract, technology is and of itself not a solution to humanity's problems, just as it is not inherently evil. In practice, however, and I think this is a really important point, we talked about this in our last AI conversation, like, his point here, he says, in practice, however, technology is never neutral because it takes on the characteristics of those who devise, finance, and regulate it. Therefore, the primary choice is not between a yes or a no to technology, but rather between constructing Babel or rebuilding Jerusalem, between a power that claims to dominate the heavens and a people who work together in the presence of God to rebuild the walls of fraternal coexistence. I think all the literary nerds out there are probably also pretty excited because Tolkien gets a direct shout out, which this has to be some kind of first in a papal encyclical. This is Tolkien writing. It is not our part to master all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us for the succor of those years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till.
Thus saith Gandalf unto Frodo.
Thus saith Gandalf, exactly. Unto Frodo.
That's awesome, yeah.
Yeah, so that's maybe a helpful overview or setup for the encyclical. We did have responses, of course. The whole world was responding. All the major news outlets, all kinds of serious thinkers. That's one of the points George Sumner made in his piece as well. He said, the Bishop of Rome alone is the person who could sound this alarm because his is the largest and most far-flung of the churches, and he is the office with the greatest vestigial spiritual weight. That still continues to be the case.
Well, now that you've brought up Bishop George's response to the encyclical, his is one of, as we mentioned, four articles that have come up on Covenant so far, and these were part of a series that immediately came out after the encyclical was released. Would the two of you just share with us some of the key connections, concerns, questions, appreciations, in other words, responses from Anglicans and Episcopalians that have been coming to the fore?
So Sam Tranter wrote one of the pieces that we published, and he's an Anglican theologian based in the UK who was the one who was invited to participate in this gathering to kind of share ideas about it. And he makes an explicit comparison between the kind of the spirit of the encyclical and the work of the kind of Christian socialist movement that arose out of 19th century Anglicanism's response to industrialism and the particular problems that it posed. I mean, he's quite enthusiastic about the wisdom of the current encyclical and sees an echo of this earlier tradition, you know, taking Christian doctrine seriously and trying to think about the social implications of that doctrine, but also, you know, kind of encouraging engagement in practical ways. I mean, one of the things about this particular encyclical that I was inspired by is that the Pope says repeatedly, you know, don't think this problem is so big that it's useless for me to be involved in it. And he suggests numerous ways that ordinary Christians can play a role. He also lifts up in many places the importance of what he calls intermediary institutions, something between the state and the market. So things like churches and schools and community groups, the kinds of things that we all have an opportunity to be involved in our own local contexts, and the kinds of organizations that frankly have shrunk in their power and dynamism in the last few generations. He says these are essential. These are essentially human things, and they're essential to facing the particular challenges posed by AI at the moment. And in that way, you know, Sam Trender says Anglo-Catholic socialists, Christian socialists were engaged in similar kinds of, you know, vivifying community associations, educational associations, and workers' advocacy groups and things like this. There's a similar need in our time today.
One of the things that Bishop Sumner highlights is that maybe actually one of the best ways to respond to this is to, again, remind ourselves what is so beautiful about the human creature that God has made. Whatever kind of attributions I think we want to make to large language models and AI is that they're not made in the image of God. And thus, the contemplation of the kind of God that makes a creature in its image is one of the things that I think can help us in, I think, the wide range and panoply of technological things that threaten who we are. The kid who is stuck to their phone is literally the Augustinian image of the person curved in on themselves, right? Like not able to not only see other people, but just not able to see like the trees and the flowers.
Bishop George, in his article, drawing attention to what is distinctive about human beings. I mean, one of the points that Bishop George makes is that we are not just intelligence. And Pope Leo brings this forward in what is, for me, the most beautiful section of this, which is the place where he talks in the third chapter about what is particularly beautiful and profound about human life. And he roots that in relationship, in the experience of suffering and learning to care for other people. You know, this is not original to him. John Paul also spoke profoundly about, wrote profoundly about this, of the importance of suffering as a school for character, of the fact that, you know, limits are gifts from God that allow us to know our proper place in the order of things. If we've been living as Christians for a long time, we see the wisdom of this, but it's quite countercultural, and it's very easy to fall into this mindset that prioritizes efficiency and utilitarian modes of judgment and to just discard so much that is irreplaceable about humanity.
Do you mind if I read just a few of those lines where the Pope is sure. talking about this? It's really beautiful. This is section 113. He says, in reality, elevating any single dimension of human existence to an absolute is always a mistake. Indeed, disorder does not arise only from scarcity. Even unchecked growth can give rise to impoverishment. Thus, intelligence, when absolutized, overshadows other essential dimensions of life, such as affection, the will, commitment, and relationships. Similarly, technological power, if left unbalanced, does not make us more capable. It makes us more isolated and more vulnerable to being dominated and excluded.
that points, I think, to one of the things that for me was most interesting about this encyclical. I mean, they call it the AI encyclical, but it's really about all sorts of things. I mean, this is a point that Michael DeLashmet makes very well in his article for Covenant, that it's an encyclical about the world that AI has created, AI, and the world that AI will shape. This is about the attention economy. It's about disinformation in public life. It's about data protection and the collapse of the post-war order and employment problems. I mean, it's extremely wide-ranging. Some people have criticized it because it's like three encyclicals in one, but I think in some ways he has his finger on the point that this shift, what he calls, following Francis, the technocratic paradigm, is driving social change on a massive scale in all sorts of ways. And you really can't navigate and narrate that story without looking at lots of these impacts.
Yeah, the way he lifts up suffering too is, I think, really remarkable. What does he say? Suffering is essential to what it means to be human. And to eliminate suffering, he says, entirely would mean, in the end, extinguishing love and desire as well. And then he goes on to quote Viktor Frankl. The Frankl quote is beautiful. He observed, in moments of horror, when we have come to know man as he really is. After all, man is that being who invented the gas chambers of Auschwitz. However, he is also that being who entered those gas chambers upright with the Lord's Prayer or the Shema Israel on his lips. A machine cannot do this, right?
I'm glad you mentioned that. And Mark, I'm glad you brought up Michael DeLashmet's essay, because there was a section toward the end of Michael's essay that I thought, what? He has some questions about the encyclical. And one of those is the fact that it just doesn't seem like Pope Leo really opens the possibility of, or is open to the possibility of, AI developing into a kind of non-human person. And in fact, when I say non-human person, I'm quoting Michael DeLashmet. If I'm reading Michael right, he himself seems to potentially be open to the possibility of AI becoming a, open quote, creature with moral standing, rights and dignities, and its place within God's good creation, close quote. I guess my final question here for you guys, or I should say my next question here for you guys, we could keep talking. Humans clearly have the gift of making. Can humans make another creature, or can we only make machines? You guys are shaking your heads and sighing.
I think we're very nervous about creating other creatures. I mean, this is, there's a beautiful old essay that Sir Oliver O'Donovan wrote 30 years ago called Begotten, Not Made. And it's about sort of, you know, the ethics of fertility and assisted reproduction and things like that. But he makes a central theological claim in that article that we're given the opportunity to transmit life, and we're given the opportunity to create things out of the good things that God has made. But to create life ourselves is to cross a line. And I know that DeLashmet is not exactly saying that we create life, but I think the idea that a non-human thing that we made would have personhood is very troubling. I mean,
I was quite confused. I was at least confused. I mean, he's drawing on Desjardins, kind of strange 20th century Jesuit, who I've never understood. Every time I read Desjardins, I think I must be a total idiot because this makes no sense to me. I'm with Mark here. I don't understand what a person could be who does not have its direct origin in God. I mean, angels are persons. They're non-human persons. I don't know how human creatures bring forth something that is called a person.
Michael DeLashmet, if you are listening right now, we like your essay. We're so glad it's on Covenant. If we are misrepresenting you, or if you can just answer our questions about this, we would love it. So that's my invitation to Michael. And if His Holiness would also like to come on the podcast and talk more about his encyclical, we would also welcome him.
That's right. We renew our request to interview the Holy Father.
We will renew our official media request. Yes, we will.
isolation, disconnection from peers, burnout. Many Christian leaders know how this feels. At The Living Church, we realized a long time ago that we weren't just here to be a magazine or a podcast, but a catalyst for connection. Through digital and in-person opportunities, we love creating a sanctuary for the shepherds, cultivating fellowship, continuity, and stability so that leaders can thrive and local churches can too. So how do we do this? Through lots of pastoral emails and phone calls, actually, with friends and subscribers like you, but also in public ways, webinars, conferences, our online covenant journal, teaching and preaching resources, and the Living Church podcast. We're called to encourage those on the front lines of parish ministry. So when you donate to The Living Church, you are funding this lifeline for connection and renewal. Whether it's $5, $50, or $5,000, your gift will not only continue the products and programs that you're enjoying right now, it will encourage and equip another leader like you. Donate to The Living Church today. You can go to livingchurch.org and click donate, or check out the link that's always in the show notes.
In the essay by Terence Chandra, he addressed this question a little bit, and he brings up Tolkien's category of subcreation, which may be what Michael DeLashmit was getting at. He said Tolkien coined the term subcreation to describe this unique human ability, the one that Mark was describing. That is, that we can participate in the bringing forth of new human life where before there wasn't a life. Although unable to summon things into being ex nihilo, we can nonetheless use what the Creator has already made, combining them in a potentially infinite number of configurations to fashion unique creations of our own. In this way, we bring beauty into the world, beauty that reflects the greater beauty of God's vast and intricate design. So the question is, what are the limits of human subcreation, to use Tolkien's phrase? Could that include something that could rightly be called a person? That seems really unlikely to me.
You know what? A parallel that occurs to me is, as someone who has written fiction, okay, this process of kind of like when you create a character, in some ways tell them where to go and what to do, in other ways they surprise you. You have a relationship with them as the author. And when you're finished with a particular story, you might miss them. There's a sense in which you can kind of miss them or wonder, you can still think about them and wonder what would they do in this or that kind of situation. There's a sense in which they do exist and you are relating to them. They don't have rights, you know, a character in a book, you know, is not going to have legal rights or something like this. But I just wonder if there's some kind of parallel there or some way of engaging with what Michael DeLashmit is proposing at the end of his essay.
I do think this is a question that will not be going away anytime soon. As the capacity of AI increases and as AI sort of things stand apart in some ways from the companies that fund them and create them, questions are going to be asked about liability and taxation and, you know, a whole series of practical legal questions. And to me, that's like a reason to kind of slow things down a little bit and make sure we know what we're talking about before we start going ahead and making it happen. Yeah, I do think we're going to be engaging with these questions in public life in various ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think your analogy is an interesting one. It made me wonder, to what extent does somebody like Flannery O'Connor address this in any of her, like, of Mystery and Manners? Like, she talks a lot about the author. Does she talk about, like, what, how to think, because she was a Thomist, right? I mean, she read Thomas every night. How did she think about characters? It makes me also wonder, like, what other sort of philosophers, like Jacques Maritain in his book on art and scholasticism, does he address this question on of the nature of a character and what kind of attribution you could make of them as they relate to human persons?
Interesting that literature and the arts has come up twice now, first with Tolkien and then with Flannery O'Connor, and in fact, the Pope quoting Tolkien and using Tolkien as a way to think about these things. So I think there's got to be a connection there, or at least something's simmering that we haven't quite worked out yet. Like, why are literary artists helpful already as conversation partners in thinking about AI. That might be worth chewing on a little more.
I mean, at least one of the reasons is that anything that AI creates that is in the realm of what we'd call the artistic.
Oh, it affects
the difference
them,
is yeah. so clear. I mean, it's like something made by a human is just categorically different.
Well, I will say I was shopping at a clothing store yesterday and a song came on during the shopping experience that was supposed to, I think, like provoke a deeper shopping experience. and it was so bad that I actually thought, I bet AI wrote this. I mean, it was just, but I probably not. It was probably a person. So I will say there are things that are written by people that are so canned and so bad, they probably could be mistaken for AI. But an AI work being mistaken for human, I suppose, would be another question. Well, why don't we move on to some international news? The next two stories that we're going to be talking about are looking at some things going on in the global church. And I want to start with a story happening in Mozambique that's been ongoing in the province of Cabo Delgado. And I wonder, Mark, could you just tell us a little bit about this story? And we'll go from there.
Sure. I mean, I think in some ways this story is a helpful link back to some themes that Pope Leo brought up in the encyclical that we've been discussing. This is a situation where a community in northeastern Mozambique, so along the Indian Ocean in southeastern Africa, has been profoundly changed over the last decade, first by the discovery of liquefied natural gas and the world's largest deposit of rubies, and then by a violent jihadist regime called the Islamic State of Mozambique, or Al-Shabaab, that has basically waged this relentless campaign against the province's Christian population that's just been devastating. And so it's, you know, part of what the Pope says in the encyclical is that we don't think about the kind of the hidden costs of these technological shifts. In a case like this, you have like liquefied natural gas. So this is a petroleum product that doesn't have to go through the Straits of Hormuz. And then you have this discovery of rubies and all these multinational companies coming in. And then you have this kind of continuous war with really brutal, I mean, a lot of rape, kidnapping, and something like 6,000 people have died over the last 10 years, and a million people have been displaced. I mean, this is a province that only has a population of 2.8 million. So it's a huge humanitarian catastrophe. And those multinational corporations are not doing a thing to be helpful, really. It's the churches in the region, the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Church and others that have stepped in to kind of fill the gap. But the need is just tremendous. So the story that was published last week was because in late April, a church in a place called Maze had been destroyed by the militants. This is one of the largest and most historic churches in the region. And there's been a kind of flare-up of violence again that's resulted in more people being displaced. We had reported on this back in September of 2025 before. Just a deep challenge. And our reporter, Daniel Sitole, has developed a close connection with the Anglican Bishop of Nampula, who has Cabo Delgado as part of his jurisdiction. And the diocese has been very involved in providing emergency relief, but also pastoral support. They have these groups called Teams of Life, where lay Christians are kind of taking unidentified children kind of who are disconnected from their families into their homes and then trying to reconnect them with their families. It's just a huge, wide-ranging effort. And the other thing that's been important here is that the Christian communities, both the Anglicans and the Roman Catholics, have said repeatedly that they do not want there to be reprisals from their own people back against the Muslims. And they've pursued various kinds of interfaith engagement. This is a region where there's always been, it's borders Tanzania. There've been Muslims in that region for 1,000 years, but it's been a relatively peaceful form of Islam and they've gotten along with the Christians on the interior pretty well. But this group has come in, a lot of it, being financed and led from outside the region and has just exacerbated this conflict. And they're basically calling for help from an international community that's not really recognizing this problem, has kind of ignored it. This is not a conflict in which we don't have some connection or stake. This is a conflict that's shaped by the same kinds of international dynamics in which we're participating, political and economic. I mean, the fact that there would be many people who would qualify for refugee status and could come to the United States, Christian refugees, but we're not letting them in anymore in this country. And so it's certainly a crisis that deserves our prayers and raises some real concerns.
Yeah. Matthew, what comes to mind for you? What stands out to you when you hear this story?
One, I think just the witness of Christians here is remarkable. And I mean, a strongly ecumenical witness, Christians joining together that their common faith and the fact that they are part of the body of Christ is more fundamental than other kinds of bonds. And I think this kind of care for each other is one kind of evangelical response to the perpetrators, right? Like in the face of this, this is what Christians do. They take in children. They care for their brothers and sisters who had their church destroyed. That's the Christian faith. And maybe that's one way to view some of the growing challenges in this country. Maybe this is an opportunity. I mean, they're not even comparable. Certainly one of the effects of challenge and suffering can be a deepening of faith, a deepening of care, of real Christian charity. I just often find it very challenging to know how to pray in ways that don't feel perfunctory about something so far away about which you have, you know, this is true about all sorts of awful situations in all kinds of places, South Sudan, Israel and Gaza, all these places. So I think prompts me to sort of ask God in prayer, like, how do I sit with this in your presence? Teach me how to pray about these things.
Can I ask you, Mark, you edit, sometimes cover these kinds of stories, and you are very involved in the global church and issues affecting the global church and are friends with many pastors and bishops around the world. How do you keep from getting just completely overwhelmed by this news?
I mean, I think you need to give people space to tell their stories. I mean, oftentimes they're very inspiring stories. It's part of the, you know, Jesus told us about this in his words to the disciples, that God will provide the strength and the wisdom to be able to stand fast and to offer a meaningful response. And I just see this happening, you know, over and over again. This is part of why I was so drawn to this section of the Pope's encyclical, where he talks about the practical differences that we can make by just, you know, building meaningful relationships, listening to one another, understanding the experiences of victims. That's all that people in this part of the world, church leaders, have to work with. I mean, thankfully, there are some ministries that are sending them some funds to buy things, but they're thrown back on their basic gifts and responsibilities as believers. And so while I hope that there will be other ways of addressing these needs opened on a broader scale, I just think it's important not to forget that God is working through this. You know, I think this kind of thing means that people will see the example of the Christians and they'll want to become Christians, that in the long term, this is the kind of thing that has been a source of renewal for the church in its witness. So I'm brokenhearted about this, of course, but do not despair, because I see the faithfulness of Christ and his church over and over again.
I think that this ties in really beautifully to the third story that we're here to talk about today, which is, I would say, the coverage that we have so far is on the character of the Anglican Church in Myanmar. One of these articles, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think one of these articles you can only currently read in the magazine in print.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, yeah. A reminder for listeners, most of our news is accessible online for free. But there are things that you are missing if you're not a subscriber to the magazine. So I'll include a link in the show notes to subscribe if you've never been a subscriber or you want to renew your subscription. So these articles were written by a man named Edward Jarvis, who teaches at Holy Cross Seminary in Yangon, Myanmar, formerly the nation of Burma. And one of the stories is about the seminary in particular and touches on current political events. And the other is, as I've said, about the character of Myanmar Anglicanism, spirituality, polity, looking at that through the lens of the history a little bit more. That second one, partly to help explain why this diocese, which is part of the Anglican Communion, would also participate in GAFCON and the Global South Fellowship, while also maintaining relationships with progressive provinces. So the Anglican Church of the Province of Myanmar has a history that includes, like many nations, colonialism and then independence, and several military governments in the wake of that independence, including currently a military government. It involved a deportation of all non-native clergy members in the 1960s, current conflict between outlying ethnic regions and the region surrounding the capital. I think that's an ongoing conflict as well. Also, a really strong embrace of Christianity there and a deep indigenization of Christianity in Myanmar, which is really beautiful. So what Edward Jarvis is giving us in these two articles is the picture of a church that's really rooted and confident in its identity and not easily alarmed by change. They're focused on the long game, and they're generally conservative in theology, as most Global South churches are. They're also conservative in the way they make decisions. They're not people who are going to be making big changes, big splashes, but they're also not put out by those in the communion who do and are willing to take hands with a diversity of Anglicans to maintain relationships internationally. So I really enjoyed these articles painting a picture for me of a church with so much patience and pragmatism and equanimity. The final thing I'll say about this is that since 2021, a lot of listeners will remember, Myanmar has been in a state of violent unrest. The country's democratically elected government was deposed by the military. Once again, they have a military government that cracks down quite brutally on groups that would protest and individuals that would protest this coup. Tens of thousands have been killed or arrested by the military junta. And so when we look at the Holy Cross Seminary, but the picture that we get of the seminary is one of just a quiet joy and warmth. And they talk about singing a lot. They're just apparently constantly whipping out their guitars and singing. When there's a blackout, which I guess there are often blackouts, you can just hear, you know, students hanging out and singing. So yeah, embracing this life of discipline, also embracing the kind of like slow, wise pace of their church more broadly, even though they're quite young. I loved soaking in these stories and getting a sense of the culture of the church in Myanmar. And I wonder what stood out to the both of you about these profiles.
I think for me, I was thinking about this partly through the lens of what we've talked about on the last few episodes, which has been this the moves by GAFCON to establish a global Anglican communion. And as a result of that, some provinces who had been very involved in the GAFCON movement, Myanmar being one of them, have sort of stepped back a little bit, not ready to move forward so quickly, wanting to keep those connections with Canterbury intact. And I think this story gives some perspective, especially the one where he looks at the wider history. And Dr. Jarvis is written the only major academic history of the church in Myanmar. So he really knows the material. I mean, this is a group of people who are marginal in their own country. They're members of an ethnic minority that's been intensely persecuted and who found protection from the British back in the colonial period, and who kind of, for them, there still is this connection that's meaningful. And you're asking a lot for them to kind of cut all those ties. And this story for me indicates a little bit of why, about what's at stake. And I think the Anglican Communion, when it can be a way to bring hope and stability and strength to churches like this, that this is part of our most important mission in a global world, to do what we can to help those churches understand their stories, support them in our prayers, and try to find ways for them to be respected and to have a stake in our ongoing work.
One of the things that struck me in this is really more a wondering, is what are the things that contributed to Myanmar's rather unique response in terms of Anglican Communion politics to being connected with GAFCON, GSFA, and not cutting off ties with parts of the Communion? I wondered culturally, like what might be present that contributes to that sort of openness or a willingness to allow things to be unresolved. But it also made me wonder too, if to what extent kind of theological orientation plays into this, because they're quite high church. I mean, the picture, I love the picture from the seminarian of these two seminarians kneeling in front of the altar. It looks like the Eucharist is reserved there. They're kind of in, you know, having Eucharistic adoration, and one of them has his hands open and he's praying. If a certain kind of Catholic ecclesiology has also contributed to this as well, because it tends to be, right, that those who have been more willing to separate have been more evangelical. You have to wonder, I think, the extent to which ecclesiology, right, where an evangelical is going to want to emphasize visible church and doctrine as the fundamental piece, whereas a sort of more Anglo-Catholic, high church, Catholic approach is going to see the sort of divine reality of the church, our incorporation into it sacramentally, and God's action, and thus the fact that we're incorporated into the body of Christ. You cannot know who is in and who is out, and thus the body is always mixed, and God will sort this out at the end. Those things together maybe contribute to that. I don't know. I find myself just so wanting to go and see, experience this. Like, what is this church like? I want to visit this seminary. Can you imagine an Episcopal seminary that has the motto, poverty, chastity, and obedience? As a seminary motto, like...
The more Catholic provinces of the Communion... This is typical of them, that this desire to kind of take the long view. In Myanmar, they have a pretty good sense that the Sea of Canterbury is going to be around in 500 years. We don't know what God has planned, but that seems to me to be a wise approach to trying to see clearly in confusing times.
Yeah, thank you. Again, I encourage our listeners to check out our website, livingchurch.org, if you are really ready to dive in and get all the news and all the stuff. Subscribe to our magazine at livingchurch.org and click subscribe, or you can click the link in the show notes today. I've been at the news desk today with the Reverend Dr. Matthew Ulver, executive director and publisher, and the Reverend Mark Michael, editor at The Living Church. Matthew, Mark, thank you so much again for coming on the show.
Thanks, Amber. This is always great.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
Preacher, are you looking for new resources to make preaching each week a little easier and, dare I say it, maybe even fun? Well, you can join Episcopal priests Father Jacob Smith and Father Aaron Zimmerman for the Same Old Song podcast. Same Old Song. Each week, they break down the lectionary texts for the coming Sunday with gospel insight, a few appropriate cultural references, sometimes slightly inappropriate, and a heart for the sufferer in the pew and the pulpit, all in half an hour. Check out Same Old Song wherever you get your podcasts, or check out the link in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in to today's News Desk. In today's bonus segment, I sat down with my friend, Doug LeBlanc. And yes, it's LeBlanc. Don't pronounce the C. The man is from Louisiana. We talk about highlights and challenges of his career as a religious journalist, including some surprising wisdom for friendships across the aisle. We also have a written interview with Doug with a whole different set of fascinating stories, like when Phyllis Tickle asked him to write a book, or Frederica Matthews Green interviewed him at a barbecue restaurant. You can find that piece by Caleb Galarraga in the show notes today. Douglas LeBlanc is freshly retired from long service as associate editor of the Living Church magazine. He's also written for Christianity Today, among many other publications, and served at St. Christopher Camp and Conference Center. He and his wife, Monica, live in Virginia, retired with their cats, Mittens, and Finn, and attend St. Matthew's Henrico. Enjoy the bonus chat. How many total years have you been in religious journalism?
Pretty much my whole career.
I'm curious, what have you seen change in journalism, maybe specifically religious journalism, over the course of your career?
I think religion journalism is about the same as daily journalism, political journalism, et cetera. There's much more of a focus on the self. I sometimes even encounter stories in which I is the first word of the first sentence, and that is just really a flashing red flag. Someone who just can't get out of their own head. I mean, that's the whole idea of old school journalism, that you can be a jack of all trades, but clearly you're not an expert at everything you write about.
Some people would think religious journalism in some ways is an oxymoron, especially if you're approaching journalism from a perspective of faith, someone who might be skeptical about that, that you're trying to do something that should be objective automatically with a very subjective lens, which is a religious worldview yourself.
Well, I had a great experience when I was working at the Daily Paper in Baton Rouge. Jehovah's Witnesses were very good there about saying, hey, we're about to meet for a weekend at the LSU Assembly Center. Please come out. And I went out one year, and they had an executive there from headquarters in Brooklyn. But we talked about how during World War II, he had served time in a federal prison because, being a good Jehovah's Witness, he had wanted nothing to do with the war. JWs see that as exercise in nationalism. They're just as troubled by giving swearing an oath in court or saluting the flag, for that matter. But I really had to respect him that he was willing to go to federal prison to stand for something that was very important to him. That became important to me because I worried that I could not be fair to people if I thought they were really on the wrong track with their faith. And that persuaded me that I could do a fine job as a religion writer. Generally, I try to write in a way that at least they'll recognize themselves in what I write and maybe even be happy that, okay, LeBlanc was fair to me.
I'm curious about, for you personally, a highlight of your career.
During my years with Anglicans United, I...
And is that a magazine or a newspaper or...
It was a movie. It was a movement.
Or a soccer team. Okay.
No, we were a movement. and we were... Anglicans United was standing about as much as one could stand against blessing same-sex unions. I befriended Louis Crewe, and he welcomed my friendship and befriended Gene Robinson when he was still running to become a bishop somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I saw this old picture of you and Gene Robinson that you emailed to me. It was a frankly adorable photo of
you
guys.
It was taken by a communicator in Rochester, New York.
Oh, it was a very sweet picture.
Gene ran first in Newark and then in Rochester, and then he won in New Hampshire. I was present for the dog and pony show and the election in both Newark and Rochester, and then missed it entirely in New Hampshire. So, and he wasn't the only person on the other side, as it were, that I became friends with. Most of those friendships seemed to just kind of wither away after the left prevailed on the question. And Louis and I stayed in touch for at least to some extent until he died. He had a great recording of Flannery O'Connor reading one of her stories. And he was in the room as she read it, so you could hear Louis' laughter on one point. That was so wonderful.
Doug, would you just say briefly who Louis is for listeners who might not know?
Oh, Louis founded Integrity, which was the central lobbying group of the Episcopal Church. It was more than a lobbying group in the sense that it would have an annual conference. So in that respect, I think it served as a movement in which gay folk could feel accepted for who they were and have a certain level of fellowship with each other.
Doug, it also reminds me that a time of conflict is and can be also a time of engagement. And so, you know, you were had an active friendship with people with whom you were on very different sides of the issue of same-sex marriage. And then when that issue really wasn't an issue anymore actively in the Episcopal Church, those friendships kind of sounds like fizzled. So it's just interesting to me that times of conflict are also times of engagement, maybe opportunities for engagement that we don't otherwise have.
And I want to give credit to Todd Wetzel on that point. I was working with him at General Convention in 1991 in Phoenix. And we were in a meeting, and then Todd said, I've got to go. I'm meeting up with Louis Crew for lunch. I was a little frightened by my counterparts on the other side until then. I realized, okay, I need to imitate what Todd is doing and try to create or step into some friendships. It was quite a liberating thing to do that. And I think as well, it's that phenomenon of activists on opposing sides of an issue coming to respect each other because both of you agree it's important enough to merit an answer. You're advocating for opposite answers. But I love that saying, game recognizes game. Mm. I'm not saying that, you know, I was some kind of goat, you know, of religion, journalism or anything. It makes me a little nostalgic, you know, for those days. But
I have never heard anyone say that, Doug.
Really?
Yes, I've never heard anyone say to sort of look back with nostalgia, and I'm sure people have it, but I've never had people say, I just look back with nostalgia on times when the controversy around Gene Robinson was swirling. Gosh, did we have some great lunches? Like, you're the first person I've ever heard express that, and I think that is a really important viewpoint. I think that's a really important experience to share. You mentioned to me in an email about this upcoming conversation that one of the drawbacks of being a writer for so long is that you tend to end up living vicariously through other people's stories. So my final question for you is, now that you're moving into retirement, what story are you hoping to be part of yourself now?
Oh, golly.
What are we going to write about Doug LeBlanc?
Oh, Lord. Other than these exit interviews, I think the only thing that'll be written about me will probably be my obituary. But I hope to step into a practice of spreading mercy and compassion and joy. But I just found that church politics and church arguments took a lot out of me emotionally. And so I just didn't feel like... Plus, I'm an introvert, so I didn't do a very good job of getting out of the house often enough. So I hope to change that in the days that remain. And it could be as simple as Meals on Wheels. I'll take communion to people at home through my parish, that kind of thing. And I hope to do a lot of listening, the kind of listening that isn't directive or I think in taking communion to some people, I'll be taking it to people who already are pretty far down the road of Alzheimer's. So that'll simply being present to them and feeling empathy for their situation and realizing I may be there, you know, within another few decades or however long.
Hmm. Well, Doug, I hope whoever you're sitting with and being with in your retirement, that this career in journalism has just been great training for those people that you'll be sitting with and listening to, and that they'll receive the fruits of that and what God has already done in your life.
Oh, thank you, Amber.
Doug, thanks so much for coming on the show for this little bonus segment exit interview, and we will miss you around here.
Thank you again.
Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. Learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. In 2 weeks, we'll be taking a summer break, but we'll be back mid-July to tour Canterbury Cathedral's stained glass studio, visit a colonial church for some semi-quincentennial festivities, and explore what priests can learn from astrophysics and UFOs. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.